From Königsberg, Murat fell back to Posen. The Prussian contingent had surrendered to the Russians. The Austrians had gone homeward to the south. Everywhere scattered fugitives, ragged, lean, and frostbitten, spread the news of the disaster. Napoleon's magic was nearly exhausted. He didn't dare to stay with his troops in Germany. He fled, post-haste, to Paris. He began to order new levies and gather fresh armies amidst the wreckage of his world empire. Austria turned against him in 1813. All Europe was eager to rise against this defaulting trustee of freedom, this mere usurper. He had betrayed the new order. The old order he had saved and revived now destroyed him. Prussia rose, and the German War of Liberation began. Sweden joined his enemies. Later Holland revolted. Murat had rallied about 14,000 Frenchmen round his disciplined nucleus in Posen, and this force retreated through Germany as a man might retreat who had ventured into a cage full of drugged lions and found that the effects of the drug were evaporating. Napoleon, with fresh forces, took up the chief command in the spring, won a great battle at Dresden, and then for a time he seems to have gone to pieces intellectually and morally. He became insanely irritable with moods of inaction. He did little or nothing to follow up the Battle of Dresden. In September, the Battle of the Nations was fought round and about Leipzig, after which the Saxons, who had hitherto followed his star, went over to the Allies. The end of the year saw the French beaten back into France. 1814 was the closing campaign. France was invaded from the east and the south. Swedes, Germans, Austrians, Russians crossed the Rhine. British and Spanish came through the Pyrenees. Once more, Napoleon fought brilliantly, but now he fought ineffectually. The eastern armies didn't so much defeat him as push past him, and Paris capitulated in March. A little later, at Fontainebleau, the emperor abdicated. In Provence, on his way out of the country, his life was endangered by a royalist mob. Fifth. This was the natural and proper end of Napoleon's career. So this raid of an intolerable egotist across the disordered beginnings of a new time should have closed. At last he was suppressed. And had there been any real wisdom in the conduct of human affairs, we should now have to tell of the concentration of human science and will upon the task his treachery and vanity had interrupted, the task of building up a world system of justice and free effort in the place of the bankrupt ancient order. But we have to tell of nothing of the sort. Science and wisdom were conspicuously absent from the great council of the Allies. Came the vague humanitarianism and dreamy vanity of the Tsar Alexander. Came the shaken Habsburgs of Austria, the resentful Hohenzollerns of Prussia, the aristocratic traditions of Britain, still badly frightened by the revolution and its conscience all awry, with stolen commons and sweated factory children. No peoples came to the Congress, but only monarchs and foreign ministers. And though you bray a foreign office in the bloodiest of war mortars, yet will its diplomatic habits not depart from it. The Congress had hardly assembled before the diplomatists set to work making secret bargains and treaties behind each other's backs. Nothing could exceed the pompous triviality of the Congress which gathered at Vienna after a magnificent ceremonial visit of the Allied sovereigns to London. The social side of the Congress was very strong. Pretty ladies abounded. There was a galaxy of stars and uniforms, endless dinners and balls, a mighty flow of bright anecdotes and sparkling wit. Whether the 2 million dead men upon the battlefields laughed at the jokes, admired the assemblies, and marvelled at the diplomatists is beyond our knowledge. It's to be hoped their poor wraiths got something out of the display. The brightest spirit of the gathering was a certain Talleyrand, one of Napoleon's princes, a very brilliant man indeed, who'd been a pre-revolutionary cleric, who'd proposed the revolutionary confiscation of the church estates, and who was now for bringing back the Bourbons. The Allies, after the fashion of peace congresses, frittered away precious time in more and more rapacious disputes. The Bourbons returned to France. Back came all the remainder of the émigrés with them, eager for restitution and revenge. One great egotism had been swept aside, only to reveal a crowd of meaner egotists. The new king was the brother of Louis XVI. He'd taken the title of Louis XVIII very eagerly, so soon as he learnt that his little nephew, Louis XVII, was dead in the temple. He was gouty and clumsy, not perhaps ill-disposed, but the symbol of the ancient system. All that was new in France felt the heavy threat of reaction that came with him. This was no liberation, only a new tyranny, a heavy and inglorious tyranny instead of an active and splendid one. Was there no hope for France but this? The Bourbons showed particular malice against the veterans of the Grand Army, and France was now full of returned prisoners of war who found themselves under a cloud. Napoleon had been packed off to a little consolation empire of his own, upon the island of Elba. He was still to be called emperor and keep a certain state. The chivalry or whim of Alexander had insisted upon this treatment of his fallen rival. The Habsburgs, who had toadied to his success, had taken away his Habsburg empress. She went, willingly enough, to Vienna, and he never saw her again. After 11 months at Elba, Napoleon judged that France had had enough of the Bourbons. He contrived to evade the British ships that watched his island, and reappeared at Cannes in France for his last gamble against fate. His progress to Paris was a triumphal procession. He walked on white Bourbon cockades. For 100 days, the 100 days, he was master of France again. His return created a perplexing position for any honest Frenchman. On the one hand, there was this adventurer who had betrayed the Republic, on the other, the dull weight of old kingship restored. The Allies wouldn't hear of any further experiments in republicanism. It was the Bourbons or Napoleon. Is it any wonder that, on the whole, France was with Napoleon, and he came back professing to be a changed man? There was to be no more despotism. He would respect the constitutional regime. He gathered an army. He made some attempts at peace with the Allies. When he found these efforts ineffectual, he struck swiftly at the British, Dutch, and Prussians in Belgium, hoping to defeat them before the Austrians and Russians could come up. He did very nearly manage this.